Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on December 19, 2013, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleform conference call on the patent system. Today's call is co-sponsored by the George Mason University School of Law's Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. All expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, please note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. For today's call, we're happy to welcome our moderator, Adam Mossoff. Adam Mossoff is a professor of law at the George Mason University School of Law and a longtime member of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Rights Practice Group Executive Committee. He's also involved with our co-sponsor today, the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason Law School, which is dedicated to the scholarly analysis of intellectual property rights and the technological, commercial, and creative innovation they facilitate. Through its annual conferences, roundtables, fellowship programs, and other academic and policy events, the center promotes a balanced discussion about intellectual property rights and their fundamental role in securing the innovation and creativity that drives both a free market and a flourishing economy. Without further, Professor Mossoff, please go right ahead and get us started.
Thank you, Dean. I'm very pleased to be moderating a discussion today between two distinguished jurors on whether the patent system is broken or working in promoting and securing new innovation. That is the Honorable Richard Posner, who currently sits on the Federal Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and the Honorable Paul Michel, former Chief Judge of the Federal Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Welcome, Judge Posner and Judge Michel. These are jurors who have immense depth of knowledge about the patent system and patent policy, as well as who have extensive experience in adjudicating patent cases during their respective tenures on the federal bench. Between the two of them, we could easily fill a short book just listing their respective achievements, accolades, and other notable successes, but I think both Judge Posner and Judge Michel, as well as our audience, would rather us get right to the substantive topic of our teleform today, patent law. So for those in the audience who may have been living under a rock for the past 20, oops, I'm sorry, I date myself. I should probably say, for those of you in the audience who've been living perhaps under an IBM mainframe computer for the past 25 years, you can certainly find a plethora of information on our two speakers on the internet. I recommend perhaps beginning with Google or Bing. Now the format of the teleforum will be as follows. Judge Posner and Judge Michel will each speak for approximately 12 minutes, and then they will each have several minutes to respond to each other's opening statements. We will then begin the question and answer period with the audience, which will take up the last 30 minutes or so of the teleforum. So without much further ado, I'm very happy to begin the event by turning our virtual microphone over to our first speaker today, Judge Posner.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to correct something. You said that extensive adjudicative experience with patent law. Well, Judge Michel's court has the monopoly on appellate adjudication of patent cases. I actually sat with Judge Michel for a couple of days several years ago as a visiting judge in his court. But also for several years now, I've been doing patent litigation as a volunteer in the district court as a trial judge, and I've also done academic writing on patent law. So I think our patent law is a failed system. I think too many patents are issued, and I think when they are issued, too many of them are upheld by the courts. I think our system for the administration of patent law is not a happy one. The Patent and Trademark Office, which issues the patents, is not adequately staffed or managed. I don't think the patent examiners have proper incentives. Of course, the validity of a patent can be challenged in court, and of course, infringement suits are brought in court. But I don't think our court administration of patent disputes is good at all. Part of the problem is expert witnesses paid by the parties. Part of the problem is the use of lay juries in patent cases. And part of the problem is the specialized appellate court, the Judge Michel's court, the Federal Circuit, because I think it's had a tendency, which you actually expect in a specialized agency of any sort, of taking a kind of promotional a view of the activity that regulates, especially since the Federal Circuit was created at a time, 1982, when there was a lot of concern that the United States was losing its technical edge to Germany and Japan. That, of course, you know, from today's perspective, seems absurd, but that was the thinking. And so I think the Federal Circuit has been too welcoming to patents, has relaxed standards for patentability. As a result, as I say, we have too many patents. Now, when you have too many patents, it means that you're providing inventors with more insulation from competition than they need in order to have adequate incentives to create inventions. You have market prices above efficient levels. You have distortions in the allocation of resources. You have wasteful patent races involving a lot of duplication of effort. You have filing of defensive patents, people who don't really want the patent, but they're worried that if they don't have a patent, they're going to be sued for infringement by someone else. And there, of course, the patent trolls who buy up, you know, large numbers of patents for the sole purpose of extracting license fees by threat of suit and, if necessary, suing. And I've dealt with trolls in cases, and I've dealt with other plaintiffs as well. So not a happy picture. Now, it's a mixed picture. I don't want to overstate my position. There's the pharmaceutical industry, which is the poster child for the patenting, and I'll come to that in a moment. Patent races, although they're wasteful, they do accelerate invention. And the requirement that patents be published does provide a lot of valuable technical information. And a related point, when patent protection is unavailable, inventors will turn, to the extent they can, to trade secrecy as a way of protecting their invention from competition. And by definition, of course, trade secrecy doesn't involve publication and so limits the dissemination of technological information. To provide a little bit of an analytical framework for discussion of, you know, the optimal amount of patent protection, it's useful to evaluate patent protection as follows. You consider the cost of inventing and the cost of copying the invention. And the higher the ratio of the cost of inventing to the cost of a patent, cost of copying, the stronger the case for a patent protection. And the ratio is very high for pharmaceutical drugs. Cost of inventing a new drug, in particular including the cost of the extensive testing that's required for a new drug, can be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Yet for most drugs, the cost of copying, of producing an identical substitute, is very low. I mean, most, not all, of course, but most drugs consist of sort of commodity chemicals. So production costs very low. And what this means is that the inventor who's spent these hundreds of millions of dollars is going to find it very hard to recoup his expenses without patent protection, because copiers can duplicate the invention, produce the invention at a very low cost and underprice him, and he'll never get his expenses recovered. So so that's the, as I say, that's the strongest case. And there are other industries that have these characteristics, but actually very few. And in most industries, there really is no need for patent protection in order to provide an incentive for a new invention. Many new inventions are inexpensive. They're ground out by teams of engineers who are employed by a manufacturer, what have you. And, you know, they're pretty well paid, but it's not a big deal. They're salaried employees whose business is invention. And even without any sort of patent protection, the first firm to invent a product usually has significant protection from competition in the near term, which is often the only relevant term. So he gets a head start. He's first in the market. He gets a head start on moving down his cost curve, right? Experience as he makes the product demonstrates ways of cutting costs and improving the product, and the first in the market, unless he's followed, you know, a day later, he's going to have this head start. That's very, very valuable. Also, the public is quite likely to identify his brand with the entire product and keep buying the brand even after there's competition, because, you know, he's gotten it. People have associated his brand name with the actual product. Also, many new products have very short shelf life. I mean, not in literal, it's not that they're going to wear out, but, you know, they're fashionable, they're fad products, they're going to be replaced. And the inventors and producers of such products, they don't need 20 years of protection. So where you see the problem of patent protection where it's not needed, it's the software industry. I don't want to say that it's never appropriate for software, but I think generally it isn't. It isn't necessary, and it's just a clog on competition and a source of wealth for trolls and trial lawyers and expert witnesses and the like. So this is a very progressive industry. There's very rapid invention. Most of the invention is incremental. It's created by teams of software engineers, usually at modest cost. These inventions are usually very quickly superseded, so that when you give 20 years of patent protection, what you're really doing is, you know, creating an enormous mass of stuff to search for in the patent office and traps for the unwary. This software innovation tends to be piecemeal. It's not entire devices, it's components, so that a cell phone, a tablet, what have you, may have tens of thousands, even more, separate components, each one of which may be patentable, resulting in huge patent thickets, creating rich opportunities for trying to hamstring competitors by suing them. And also for, you know, in a sense, to infringe and then challenge the validity of the patent when the patentee sues you, and that sets the stage for some kind of settlement, some reasonable license fee. Also, as I understand it, the patent office has a shortage of patent examiners with the requisite technical skills. The judges and jurors are often at sea trying to understand technology. The difficulty of assessing damages for infringement of a component rather than a complete product is really acute, because you have to somehow figure out what value do the consumers attach not to the product but to one little component of it, one of the many functionalities of a software device. And because the software industry, the internet-related industry, computer-related industry generally, has historically been a very unstable, you know, companies rise and they're immensely successful, and some new device is invented. Now they're bankrupt. Maybe a lot of, you know, major firms have disappeared. So that makes these companies very anxious, both to get patents and fight patents. So pharmaceuticals and software, those are the extremes in terms of how much patent protection we want and where we want it. But my sense, and there's an extensive academic literature on this, is that in general we have too much patent protection. I'd go farther, although it's not the subject of our discussion, say in general we have too extensive intellectual property law. We're too hung up on the evils of copying. So that that completes my opening comment.
Thank you, Judge Posner. Judge Michelle?
Well, first I'd like to compliment my friend and former colleague, Judge Posner, for studying the patent system as it appears to operate, for bringing his acute knowledge of business economics to bear in that quest, and particularly for taking the trouble to try quite a number of patent infringement cases as well as to sit with the Federal Circuit. So he's a very well-informed commentator from many respects. I can only wish that before it made such extensive alterations to the substantive patent law, the Congress had heard from judges who implement patents and enforce patents, and Judge Posner and perhaps I and others might have been very productive witnesses, but we were not called on, and I think that's probably unfortunate. Judge Posner and I share having no financial stake in patent policy debates because we're not affiliated with any particular corporation or technology or other economic sector. And once again, a little bit of a contrast with the vast majority of witnesses who testified before Congress in 7 years of hearings, almost all of whom had extremely specific bottom line interests, which drove the assertions and claims that they made. I disagree strongly with my colleague as to whether the system is a failed system. I think it's a highly successful system. Of course, it has friction points, it has shortcomings, it has flaws like all institutions administered by humans. But to say that it's broken or failed, I think hugely overstates the real situation. I think Judge Posner and I probably both agree that in order for the patent system as an overall system to function efficiently and fairly and effectively, both the courts and the patent office, other actors as well, but particularly those two, need themselves to be functioning well, which means first and foremost to have adequate resources, experience, and other things of that sort. I think that the recently enacted law had some benefits, but basically missed the target in terms of what was really needed. It seemed to me what's needed first and foremost is to remedy the flaws and oil the friction points. So, for example, when Judge Posner mentions that patent examiners, particularly in the past, have been too few in number and too limited in experience, I entirely agree with that, and I'm extremely encouraged that since the advent of the leadership of Director Kappos in mid-2009, that enormous improvements have been made in the patent office. The size and quality of the board has doubled and more so. Several thousand examiners have been added to the core. The level of experience has gone up sharply. The attrition rate has gone down sharply. Much greater training and supervision has been instituted so that examiners and re-examiners and board members now have much greater training in legal aspects like claim construction, which is critical, and the importance for patentability reviews and validity determinations of paying close attention to all the requirements, including for adequate written description commensurate with what's claimed, for due enablement information, and of course stronger enforcement of the non-obviousness requirement. Certainly the patent office today is far from perfect, but it is vastly improved in every imaginable way compared to 4 years ago. And to his great credit, Director Kappos has put in place a management team of over a dozen senior executives of extraordinary ability and dedication. So I think we have every reason to expect the continuing path of patent office improvement to stay on a straight line for years to come. Now, as to the courts, again, resources are a problem. In my judgment and that of the Judicial Conference, there are significantly too few judges, particularly trial-level judges, and especially in the major urban areas, such as where Judge Posner judges. The Judicial Conference has asked every Congress for significant increases, again, particularly in trial judges in such districts, and has been mostly rebuffed. And the result is that in both the patent office and in the courts, there has been a huge problem of delay, a huge problem of unpredictability, often excessive costs, and these are huge burdens on the efficacy of the system that are easy to remedy with the adequate resources and leadership. Now, in terms of whether we should change patent terms, I don't really see the harm in patents being 20 years, even in technologies that might have a very fast change situation, as he suggests is true in much of the software industry, because patents that have no commercial value normally aren't asserted, aren't enforced. If they've become passé and it's technology that's been bypassed, they're there. They still run the 20 years, but they don't seem to cause much problem that I can see. So I don't see much benefit in trying to shorten patent term and say it's, you know, 3 years for software and 5 years for this and 10 years for that and 20 years for something else. I don't think it's really needed, and I don't think it would actually work very well. I actually overall have the sense that the all the private actors in the system have hugely important roles. It's not only the judges, not only the patent office examiners and higher officials. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of inventors, of scientists, of engineers, of corporate executives, of managers in all sorts of technologies and sectors of the economy. I have a lot of confidence in the intelligence and knowledge of those people to be able to assess accurately what they ought to be doing. And, you know, when we talk about the patent system, it's the proverbial iceberg, the part that's most visible, particularly with press coverage of dramatic cases, is a tiny part of the total system. It shouldn't be thought of as a litigation system, in my view. It's really more of a disclosure system, as Judge Posner noted, a technology sharing system, but it's also licensing. You know, for every patent that gets litigated, there are thousands of privately agreed on licenses between and among actors, often cross licenses, often large patent pools. And it looks to me like that system is actually working quite well on the whole. I think we have the best patent system on the planet. It's widely imitated more and more by other systems. I think given the acute need to create more jobs and more income for individuals, for families, for governments, for everyone else in the economy, we actually need a stronger patent system, not a weaker patent system. We need a patent system that's broadly available to all technologies, all size and types of companies, not just giant pharmaceutical companies. So I think I would prefer to see things move in the opposite direction than what it seems Judge Posner would prefer. And I also have to respond to the criticism of the Federal Circuit. My impression is that the Federal Circuit, rather than being some sort of reflexively, excessively pro-patent court, has actually been quite balanced and has given quite strong enforcement to the non-obviousness requirement, to limiting what kind of economic testimony is admissible on damages. And Judge Posner, Judge Rader, I, and many others have all contributed to trying to exclude junk economics, if I can use that phrase, and that movement continues, and it should. And just like other aspects of the litigation or patenting operation, the path forward for economic benefit for the country and all the constituent players is for the system to operate faster, less expensively, less disruptively, cheaper, more predictably, with a lower error rate. I think the error rate in patent grants and successful enforcement has greatly improved in the last 5 to 10 years. The Supreme Court has had a hand in that. The Federal Circuit has had a hand in that. Many trial judges have contributed to it, including Judge Posner, including recently in a case we've all read about. So to me, that's the path toward a continued strengthening of this engine of economic growth. And I don't see good alternatives. If the question is, should we have market-driven, private actor-dominated system, or should we have more government regulation by the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, or more micromanagement by the Congress, I for one, would greatly prefer the former. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, Judge Michel. We will now take just a couple minutes for each of the judges to respond to each other's comments. So first, Judge Posner.
Well, yes, let me just respond to a couple of specific points. First, I worry about the Patent and Trademark Office, especially if there's an expansion in patent protection, as Judge Michel was advocating. Because the discretionary budget of the federal government is likely to be cut very substantially, and I don't know whether the Patent and Trademark Office is completely self-financing from fees or gets an appropriation, but it doesn't matter which. If when the government starts squeezing down agencies to get money for entitlements or what have you, or to pay off, or to pay down the federal deficit, I think the courts are going to have budgetary problems, and the Patent and Trademark Office. Now, Judge Michel frightened me a little bit when he suggested that patent protection should be expanded to all technologies, because, as I said in my opening remarks, For most inventive activity, the incentives are quite adequate without patent protection. So when you throw in patent protection on top of normal incentives, all you do is increase the costs of the competitive process by entangling firms in patent litigation. Now, it's true, most of the litigation gets resolved often before there's even litigation, but threat to sue precipitates negotiation of a license. But of course, the firm that pays a license fee, that's a real cost. And if it's paid for in order to get out from under the threat of a patent suit, even though there was no need to grant the patent in order to generate adequate incentives for invention, then that's a wasted expense. Also, with regard to these old patents, 20-year-old patents and so on in the software industry, the problem is that a firm that's, say, challenging the validity of a patent, maybe a perfectly good patent, this firm may go back 20 years, find some patent in the record and say, in the patent office records, and say, this was an anticipation of this current invention. And then you have a lot of uncertainty as to, was it really the same invention or what? I've seen these problems. You can have a patent a defendant challenging validity and say, look, here are 20 anticipations of the invention. But I do want to make a couple of constructive suggestions. The radical reform of the patent system is not to be expected. First is, there's a new program, which is good, which is encouraging federal district judges who have some taste or interest in technology to take a disproportionate number of the patent trials. And that's a good development. But there's no, but these judges need training, and there's the training that has been arranged by the Federal Judicial Center for these judges is very, very slight. So this is a problem. So it's good to have some semi-specialized district judges to conduct patent litigation, but they need training. That's one thing. Second thing, if we're stuck with juries in patent cases, as we appear to be when the patentee is seeking damages, then, you know, the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution clicks in, and it's an entitlement to a jury trial. And patentees love jury trials because juries love patents. It's a serious problem. So there's a really big burden on the district judge, which I don't think that many judges actually carry well, to make sure that the jurors really understand what's going on in a case that involves complex technology. And I think it's possible to do that, but it requires a lot of work by the judge. I think also we have a serious problem with expert witnesses. And that's not just in patent law. But these people are paid very well by their clients, and they're representatives of their clients. And if you have a jury confronted with dueling experts, I don't know how they're supposed to figure out who's telling the truth. And I think the answer is the appointment of court-appointed experts, neutral experts, which is what I've been experimenting with in the last couple of years. And you can have them, for example, nominated by the party experts. Have the party experts get together and agree on a neutral expert, and then he's appointed by the court. His bill for his time preparing and testifying and so on, it's split between the parties, so there's no, he's not beholden to either party. And the judge can tell the jury, you know, this is the neutral expert. He's not beholden to either party. You'll listen to the party experts too, but you know, listen especially hard to this guy. And in the case of damages experts, computation of damages, that's a real weak area. That is really a weak area. And again, the judge, I think, should appoint a neutral expert and tell the jury he's a neutral expert. So I think there are a lot of, you know, incremental improvements that can be made in the system. But I think the basic system, here Judge Michelle and I disagree, but I think the basic problem is that patents are being granted in many cases in which the non-patent incentives for invention are quite adequate, and granting patents just clogs the process.
Thank you, Judge Posner. And then last, for our response comments before we open up for a question-answer period, will be Judge Michelle.
Well, I think where Judge Posner and I most fundamentally agree is that the ultimate goal is adequate incentives for invention, innovation, and the investment that is often required to get adequate levels of invention and innovation. I understand him to believe that the market incentives are already ample, and that the patent system as currently administered is just a drag reducing market incentives. My impression is exactly the opposite, that the incentives are not adequate, and that's why I think a stronger patent system is what the country would most benefit from, not a weaker system. Almost all the companies and all the private equity managers, venture capitalists, big banks, the rest, and all the operating companies are sitting on enormous amounts of cash. Part of that, of course, is because we're in an ongoing serious recession, and so demand is much more slack than it otherwise would be. But in my view, part of it is that the patent system has been so excessively criticized with overstated claims by many commentators that it has been substantially weakened in the last 5 or 7 years, and that as a result, the investment in private money, and there's no government money. He's quite right when he says government support of all sorts of things is going to be going down even sharply, even soon, including government investments in various forms of technological advance through R&D funding. So it's going to have to come from the private sector if it's going to come from anywhere. And my understanding is that there is a significant drying up of private sector capital investments in R&D and the follow-on stages like commercializing a product, scaling up to build factories and hire workers to produce the product, establishing the distribution and marketing channels, and then the final fourth step that also needs a separate increased dosage of outside capital is when those small, new, and middle-sized innovative firms make an initial public offering of stock. Well, all that requires successive investment. It's not happening nearly fast enough now, so I conclude the incentives are not adequate now and that we need sharply increased incentives.
Thank you, Judge Michel. Dean will now go to the audience for question and answer.
We've got three people lined up so far, Adam. Should we go to the first one?
Yes, excellent.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. As a computer professional, I see the chilling effect of the patent system on R&D and investment in production, and suggest there may be ways to tweak the patent system to improve it. We could return to the earlier period of 17 years and to restrict exclusive right to produce something to only the first 7 years, and thereafter only a right to collect royalties and put a cap on royalties so that anyone undertaking to invest in a product would have some way to predict his maximum exposure in case his investment was challenged and he had to pay royalties. What do you think about that?
So, no, I think the details, I wouldn't know enough about the 17 years. But the general point is very good because, you know, because of discounting to present value, the prospect of some reward for an invention 20 years from now, 17 years from now, 8 years from now, usually will not be very influential in people's investment decisions. And that's why the longer the patent term, the more those later years in the patent, 20, 25 in case of drugs, what have you, those years have very little incentive effect on current decisions about invention. But they're going to be a big drag on new inventions 20, 25 years hence because they're all going to be sitting there, all published, all in the records, ready to be taken out and used as a threat against a new inventor to obtain a license fee or other concessions. So I think shortening the term, and I thought the idea was ingenious to have 7 years of complete control over the invention and then another 10 years of a limited return. I think that's interesting, but how it would be implemented and how feasible, I don't know enough.
Judge Michel?
I don't think the main issue is whether it's 15 years, 17 years, 20 years, or what. The underlying issue to me is who's going to decide. I have much more confidence myself in district judges to adequately modulate remedies, exclusion of evidence, guidance to the jury, and all the other aspects of managing a complex trial, compared to having one-size-fits-all blunderbuss approach by the Congress or some government agency. I agree with the questioner that the more predictability we can put in the patent system, the better for business actors and everyone else involved. But I think it's better to have everything tailored to the circumstances of the particular case rather than some sort of one-size-fits-all set of rules.
I don't share your confidence in the district judges, and neither do you, because look at the reversal rate by the Federal Circuit of the district judges.
Well,
It's a very high reversal rate.
Well,
they're doing such a great job. Why are you reversing them all the time?
Well, you know, it depends how you measure things. If you count as a reversal, suppose you have 5 patents, 20 claims, and one claim is held to be poorly interpreted by the trial judge. If you count that as a reversal, then you get a very high rate. If you count that as mostly an affirmance, then you get a very low reversal rate.
I wouldn't count
a lot of this is in the counting.
No, those aren't counted as reversals. Partial affirmances are, the usual judicial statistics, a partial affirmance is treated as an affirmance. No, I think you have a very high reversal. I think there's a very high reversal rate by the Federal Circuit.
Well, you know,
and realistically, a lot of these judges, you know, a lot of judges, they're not good managers. And as a result, these patent cases drag on with the endless discovery. Now, there are some judges who are great about this, like Judge Crabb, district judge in Madison, Wisconsin. She sets really tight discovery deadlines, and that has a tremendous effect. And also, in my experience also, the lawyers are very good about complying with tight deadlines. They'd like to have indefinite discovery. It's very lucrative, of course. But if the judge is firm, the lawyers will go along, they'll cooperate. But many judges, partly because of heavy caseload, they can't impose that kind of discipline on the lawyers. And as a result, these patent cases can drag out for many years. A very serious problem, I think.
Well, we certainly need enough judges to closely monitor discovery and other pretrial phases of patent and other commercial litigation cases, which goes back to the need for adequate resources for that part of the patent system. But I think that the fact that judges, and Judge Crabb is not the only one, can innovate and police discovery and other deadlines, and the fact that judges like Judge Posner himself can exclude improper expert damages reports and evidence actually proves the system can work. And I see huge improvements over the last 5 to 10 years in judicial handling of cases. Is it perfect? Of course not. Is it a lot better than it was? Yes. Does it look like it's still getting better? Yes. With this new program of the patent pilot judges specializing, as was mentioned, in patent cases, I think you'll see a great broadening of best practices being adopted all around the country by these and other judges who are trying these patent cases. Many districts have now adopted local patent rules, which can also help. I see a lot of reforms and a lot of reason to expect continuing improvement.
I hope
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Michelle and Judge Posner, for that great exchange, great discussion about the interplay between the appellate courts and the trial courts on patent cases. Dean, do we have any more questions in the queue?
Yes. The audience is waking up. We have 5 questions. Should we go to the next one?
Excellent. Yes.
Marianne McGrail, I'm an attorney in D.C. What sorts of issues, problems, do foreign patent systems, in particular the increasingly expanding patent system in China, pose for the American patent system?
Judge Michelle, would you like to start with that question first?
Well, I think the global competitiveness of American firms is very important, along with job creation and revenue enhancement for everyone. It's near the top of the list. I don't think that the fact that China is trying to institute a serious intellectual property system, including adequate protections, is a threat to America or American companies. I think it's probably a benefit. But the real question is whether we do enough innovation here, enough development of new products, enough leadership technologically to be at the forefront of things on a global perspective, and therefore able to greatly increase our exports, which would resolve our terrible balance of payments problems and greatly boost the American economy. So I see an opportunity, not a threat, from foreign patent systems.
Judge Posner?
Yes. I don't know a great deal about foreign patent systems. In fact, I know very little. But what has been the historical pattern with intellectual property generally is that countries that produce a lot of intellectual property adopt strong intellectual property laws to protect it. And the countries that don't, they don't enforce intellectual property law because they're just consumers, so they don't have producers. And, of course, with countries like China and other countries that we used to call, you know, third world or backward countries, Brazil and Chile and Mexico and all sorts of countries, as they develop their own intellectual property industries, they adopt patent and copyright laws that are basically similar to ours, although there are differences, but there are also some international conventions that create uniformity, like the Berne Copyright Convention. So I think that's fine, and I think we actually benefit from foreign countries adopting strong intellectual property reasonable intellectual property regimes. But so far as the question of America maintaining a technological edge, I don't really think patents are the big thing there. There's a lot of criticism of our tax system, and the tax system can be adjusted to encourage invention. In fact, we do have encouragement, you know, deductions for research expenditures. They can be altered in various ways. But also, the simplest way to stimulate American technological innovation is simply to encourage immigration of technically skilled foreigners, because a huge number of people want to come to the United States. And there's been resistance. I mean, obviously, a lot of very able foreign technical people have come to the United States and played a really big role in our industries. But there is resistance from Americans to competition of the foreigners. And if we were more welcoming to foreign scientists and engineers, that, I think, would do more for our technological progressivity than expanding patent protection. Because the patent protection, I think Judge Michelle would agree, there is a double-edged quality. You strengthen intellectual property, you help some producers, you hurt others who are the competitors with the first group. So it's, and you know, there are cost limitations and ability limitations in the judiciary. So I don't think we can do much more with patent law to encourage technological innovation.
Thank you. Dean, is there another question in the queue?
Let's go to the next caller.
Oh, hi, this is Joe Mullen from Ars Technica. Judge Posner, you said earlier in your talk that patentees love jury trials because juries love patents. Could you elaborate a little bit on what is it about our trials that is making juries love patents, and how could juries have a more balanced view of our patent system?
Yes. Well, the basis of my saying that is a statistical study which found that in jury trials, the patentee, the plaintiff in a patent infringement suit won, I think, I don't have the statistics before me, I think about two-thirds of the plaintiffs were prevailing before the jury. And the reason seems to be twofold, and they're closely related. The first is the notion that, really three reasons. First, the notion is that the patentee is defending a property right. The second is that the patentee is an inventor, and we admire inventors. We think of Thomas Edison and so on. So he's a good guy. And third, hostility to the concept of inventing around, which now inventing around is not only lawful, it's highly desirable. That is the reason for, or a reason, major reason for requiring publication of the patents is to help people learn to invent things. Now, they can't invent the exact duplicate. That would be infringement. But they can learn from the patent how to manufacture a substitute, which is not infringing because it differs in critical respects, but it's going to be very similar and accomplish the same purpose. That's inventing around. It's perfectly a good thing. But jurors apparently regard inventing around as just infringement by another name. So apparently the deck is stacked against you if you are defending against an infringement suit. So the result is that a very large number of cases involving very technical stuff go before a jury of, you know, six or eight laypersons, and they can be lost. Now, I think the judges can do a lot to help the jury, but it is an uphill fight.
Judge Michel?
Well, there are new avenues added to pre-existing ones to go back to the patent office to challenge the validity of patents. They're being used quite frequently. The new procedures put the matter before a very high-level group of experienced people with technical expertise and also great legal training, who are the new members of the patent board, previously patent trial or previously the Patent Board of Appeals and Interferences and now called the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. And in addition, there are great opportunities on summary judgment before trial and on post-trial motions after a verdict, if it is an errant verdict with respect to validity, for the district judge to correct that. That's part of the job of the district judge. It's being used with increasing frequency in both the pre- and post-trial stages, and it probably should be. I have no way of accurately knowing whether or to what extent or how often lay jurors are biased in favor of the patent owner, but let's assume that there is some significant level of bias. The correction is for the trial judge to do his or her job diligently, and more are doing so.
Thank you. Dean, we'll take another question from the queue.
Okay.
Hi, I'm an attorney in D.C., and I had a sort of a follow-up to one of Judge Posner's suggestions earlier. I think both commentators have said that there are things district judges can do to make sure that juries understand complex technology, and other than the suggestion of court-appointed neutral experts, I'm wondering if either of you have any specific suggestions in that regard.
This is Judge Michel. I think there's an opportunity to use special masters appointed by the district judge to manage certain parts of the case, possibly claim construction by a technologically and legally trained expert could be of great assistance to the district judge, and it would have great downstream benefits. If the claims are accurately construed as to their scope, particularly in light of the requirements for adequate written description and enablement, then the infringement and validity decisions made later, whether by the district judge or the jury or in the final analysis by the district judge, would be much more accurate. And we all want it to be more accurate. We all want it to be more balanced. We want it to be fair. I'm not saying that more remedies the better. I'm saying remedies where there's real infringement and a valid patent. But that's not the same as saying let's just have more patents regardless of their validity, or let's have indefinite patents, or let's have patents that are inappropriate, quite the opposite. Let's have a system that operates much more efficiently than it has sometimes in the past. We're moving in that direction, and we ought to keep doing so.
Well, I have some very specific suggestions about conduct of patent jury trials. One is, and this applies to all trials, but I allow jurors to ask questions, out loud, because I think it's very important to make jurors feel that they're real participants in the process. They're not dummies sitting there being spoon-fed by lawyers and judges. So if you want to ask questions, they ask questions. That's fine. Another thing with regard to specifically the patent trials, I tell the lawyers that your instructions to the jury and the way you talk to the jurors and the way I'll talk to the jurors, I don't want you to use any patent jargon and I don't want you to use any technical jargon. You're just going to have to explain everything in words of one syllable. And you don't have to use words like anticipation, anticipation, prior art, these are terms that are very misleading to a layperson. So find a synonym, right? Say prior art, it's an earlier invention, or it's an article that described a similar invention, something of that sort. So just make it very, very simple. And I do, and with the neutral experts, I tell them, these are professors. So I tell them, look, this is like when you're talking to a jury, this is like explaining your subject to the most elementary course, the very beginning course in computer science or pharmaceutical treatments or something like that, or some disease. And so I think if one manages the trial with recognition of the limitations that the jurors bring to it, there's a chance, at least, that they're going to that they're going to understand. And as I say, there is this built-in bias, and you have to explain to them. There are inventions that are patentable, and there are some that aren't, and there are. And, inventing around, using information in a patent to build a similar but not identical product, that's perfectly good. That's how technology, how disseminates and products are improved and so on. So I think a lot can be done, but I think it's very hard, and it's not the way judges usually think about things. They usually take instructions out. The instructions usually come out of what courts have said and a lot of gibberish, whether technical or legal. And so, it's extra work for a judge, just as having a court-appointed expert is extra work for a judge. So, and of course, as Judge Michelle has pointed out, we don't really have a surplus of judges, so they're rushed, and it's hard for them to give these cases all the attention the cases require.
Thank you, Judge Posner. Well, we seem to be coming to the end of our teleforum time, and so I thought that maybe we could have just a moment where we could have some concluding remarks from both of our discussants. Since we start with Judge Posner, I think it would be great to end with Judge Michelle. So, Judge Posner, how about you go first, take a minute or two to sum up, and then we'll conclude the teleform with Judge Michelle.
Well, I, of course, Judge Michelle is much deeper in the heart of the patent system than I am. And so, I certainly give weight to his optimistic view. I would not support any expansion of the patent system. I feel pretty confident about that. But some of the improvements that he's noted, for example, in the patent office, I wasn't aware of, and I think that's great. I hope they continue. So, it may be that I'm too pessimistic. I think he's too optimistic. But maybe somewhere in between is the path of reform.
Thank you. Judge Michelle?
Well, I certainly believe in reform and continuing improvement in every important activity of people in the economic sphere and other spheres. I think there's been a huge upgrade in the performance of the patent office in the last 4 or 5 years. I think the same thing is true in the courts, despite a shortage of an adequate number of trial judges. And a great many innovations, such as those described by Judge Posner himself, have been tried by him and many other district judges. And where they've worked well, as many of them have, they're being widely adopted by others. And I disagree that the training for the new pilot program judges is inadequate. I've had some involvement in it, and it's quite extensive, and in my opinion, it's quite good. And these judges, above and beyond training by professors or practicing lawyers or technology people or others, are teaching one another what's worked well. Some of the very things Judge Posner gave us as examples are being tried by many judges, and then that success is being shared with the other judges, and those practices are then being adopted widely across the country. So I see not only the need, but the fact of continual improvement. And so I say, let's not destroy or severely weaken the system at the very time when it's working better and looks like it will continue to do so.
Thank you. Well, this was a fascinating discussion, far-ranging and touching on many, many issues of, I think, importance to both stakeholders in the patent system and to the public at large. I'd like to thank the Honorable Richard Posner and the Honorable Paul Michel for taking time out of their very busy schedules to discuss these very important issues with us.
And this is Dean Royer. Let me, on behalf of the Federal Society, thank both and also thank our moderator, Professor Adam Mossoff. Let me advise our audience that we are hopeful of doing an in-person program on these same issues as soon as March, likely here in Washington, D.C., so please visit our website for further details on that as they develop. Also to our audience, I, of course, invite you to join our teleforum call tomorrow on gun rights and gun litigation at this same number at 12 noon Eastern time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.